Bob Hansen here. Can you hear me, Foreman?
I hear you, yeah. Are you the only one? I said there's five.
Yeah, the rest of them are being silent.
Say, Bob?
Yes.
Did Steve send you a copy of my suggested revision of what Paul wrote?
I didn't get it. At least I checked my email just a few minutes ago, and there wasn't anything there yet.
Maybe he didn't get what I sent. Okay. Mostly minor revisions, I think.
Yeah, I had some comments, too, but I didn't send anything out. The moving target.
Yeah.
Somebody else just joined us, it sounds like.
Guess so.
Yep, it's Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hey, Paul.
Bob,
hey, Hansen. Paul Foreman here.
Bob Hansen.
Morning, Foreman, Bob.
Paul, did Steve send you the suggested revision of what you wrote yesterday?
I haven't seen it yet, but on the other hand, I didn't check my email this morning. Maybe I should have, huh? Hold on. No, I don't have anything.
Hello, this is the NIST group joining the call.
Something just came in from Steve, Foreman. Steve, can you tell us who's with you?
Yes, I sure can. Sean Sunder, Terry McAllister, Dick Gann, John Gross, Mike Newman, Melissa Lieberman, and myself.
Okay, thank you. Welcome all.
Steve, it's Matt Heyman. I just joined as well remotely.
Hi, Matt.
Everybody should be aware that, this is Sean here, everybody should be aware this is being audio webcast. That means the public can dial in or log in from the website and can listen to the proceedings this morning. But they will not, they don't have access to voice, so their voice will not be heard by anybody on the conference call. The voice is limited to the advisory committee and the NIST participants, as well as at the public comment period. There will be we have a request for two individuals requested to speak to the advisory committee. With that, Paul, I just want to Jim Hill was going to be here to try and welcome you folks, but I guess maybe he's not on the phone. If he's not, then let me, on behalf of Bill Jeffrey and Jim Hill, welcome you to NIST for this meeting, and I'll turn it over to Paul from here on.
Okay, thank you, Sam. Just a question before I open the meeting. Steve, you'll be taking minutes of this?
Yes, I will.
And would you please poll the committee members that are on to establish a quorum?
Yes, I will. You want me to do that now, Paul?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, we've established that you're on the call. John Barsom, are you with us? John? Okay. Charlie Thornton? Okay. Bob Hansen?
Bob Hansen.
Hi, Bob.
Hi,
John Barsom.
Oh, good morning, John.
Good morning. Morning, Bob.
Morning, John.
Okay. I lost my account there. I know Kathleen Tierney is not able to join us this morning. David Collins? Foreman Williams?
I'm here.
Hi, Foreman.
Hi.
So we have four members of the committee. currently on the phone, and that's a simple majority.
Of the currently, there are 7 members on the roll, and a simple majority for the quorum is 4. So, Paul, I guess we meet the quorum requirement.
Yes, we do, and the minutes should reflect that, Sean.
I think we should also note that half of those people are on the West Coast, and it's still dark there. Is that right?
Some of us are in the North, Foreman, and it's dark up here, too. With that, I will call the meeting to order, and I'd like to welcome everyone to the meeting. One of the things I was going to open with was some of the information that Sean just related relative to the technical aspect of the conference call that we're using. The world at large could be listening to every word that we say, not to make you nervous, but they will not be able to provide comments during the context of the meeting until 10:30, or after 10:30. At 10:30, we will take a 5-minute break. To allow time for the NIST people to make contact with 2 individuals who have indicated they would like to address the committee during the public comment period. Those commentators will be limited to the usual 5 minutes to make their comments, and in addition to that, their comments should be limited, and I will remind them at the time that they join us, to the issue of what they believe we should be reporting to Congress in our 2006 report. In the meantime, they will have been able, if they so chose, to listen to all of the deliberations that went on during that time period. Relative to the actual conduct of the meeting itself, I know people will probably want to be able to ask Terry questions when we get into the second part of the meeting. And to do that, we need to have some sense of order because I won't be able to see you raise your hands. So what I will do is at appropriate breaks when Terry so chooses will be to ask in alphabetical order if anybody has any questions or comments for the first go-around, so that we have some semblance of order and everybody doesn't find themselves talking over somebody else. So that means I would start, John, with you, and then work my way down the list to you, Foreman. And then just to be fair, on the other end, when we start to talk about the report itself, I'll reverse the alphabetical order, and Foreman, you can lead off first. And I'll end up with John as last. That will be the only way I can think of how to conduct this. I've done this before, and it seems to work out reasonably well. So if you would just wait until I call your name, if there is in during a question or comment or discussion period, as to a way that we can just present some semblance of order during the context of the meeting itself. With that, I have no real other opening remarks to make, and I guess in Jim's absence, Shem, I would ask if you have any additional comments you'd like to make before Terry begins to discuss the WCC.
Just as you did that, Jim has arrived. Of course, Jim is the at this point the acting deputy director for NIST. I'm the acting director of the Building and Fire Research Laboratory, and therefore the liaison to the committee, but I'll turn it over to Jim.
Morning, Jim.
Good morning. Who's on the phone?
There are Paul Fitzgerald, Bob Hansen, John Barson, and Foreman Williams are the 4 committee members, so we do have a quorum of 4 of 7, which is a simple majority. And Matt Heyman, and I believe those are the only other people on the phone. I mean, I just want to make sure, are those the only people on the phone? Are there anybody else on the phone?
Okay.
Well, you wouldn't be able to hear any of the public people.
No, there will be a lot of people, public, listening to the audio webcast.
Right.
Well, thank you all for joining. I think Bill Jeffrey would be here this morning if he weren't out in Boulder right now, so... just on behalf of him and behalf of NIST, thank you all for joining us. I don't really have any prepared remarks to make. I'm going to sit in as long as I can on the conference call, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. Sean, of course, is going to tell you the status of what we're doing on the investigation of WTC-7, and either now or during the course of the conversations, if you have any general questions for NIST as a whole, for the director, you know, I'll try to address them. Things haven't changed a great deal since we had a meeting here and we spoke with you all. We're right now heavily in our 07 and 08 budgeting processes, and of course it looks like for the time being we're going to be on a continuing resolution for an extended period of time, if not the whole year, and that kind of puts things up in the air a little bit here as far as plans for 07, but it really doesn't affect, I think, the operations of this particular activity. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you have or respond on behalf of Bill to anything you would like to address to me.
John, do you have any questions or comments for Jim?
No, sir.
Bob?
No, I don't.
Foreman?
No comment.
I have none either, Jim. I'm assuming from your comments then you will be sitting in throughout the two-hour meeting?
Paul, I can barely hear you.
I'm sorry. I'm assuming that you will be sitting in.
Yeah, I'm going to try to stay as long as I can. I don't know how long the meeting will go, but if I have to slip out, I'll tell you before I slip out.
Okay, fine. Thank you. With that, Sean, is there anything else?
No, I think at this point I'll simply say that I'll put on my lead investigator hat and say that we've since the October release of the final report last year, I just want to give you a quick update on what's happened. We've worked vigorously with the standards and codes organizations, including the ICC process and the NFPA process, as well as the group of the building code experts that we had given a contract to via NIST to help us in formulating code change proposals. A large number of them were actually submitted by the March 24th deadline for the IBC process. The initial hearings were held this September. And this is the set of hearings where the all of the stakeholders, including the private sector, weighs in. The outcome, in fact, in my view, was far better than I would have expected, and my initial expectation was that most of the code change proposals would not be approved. However, we were pleasantly surprised that three of them that deal with the fireproofing requirements were approved, both in terms of the bond strength, the quality control of the fireproofing, and the property performance requirements for fireproofing. In addition, the industry came strongly forward to say that they are going to develop an alternative proposal for progressive collapse. And there's a very robust industry group led by NCSEA, the National Council for Structural Engineers Associations, and a whole host of structures organizations that are developing consensus-based alternative proposal. And they have promised to put forward such a proposal for the next code cycle, for which the submission date is August of next year. And there are several other changes that are being working their way not only through the ICC process, but also through ASME, AFCE, ASTM, and a range of other NFPA, and a range of other organizations. So we are committed to working with those organizations, and we'll continue to do that in the next few years. With regard to World Trade Center 7, our staff now since last November has been redirected to working toward the problem of analyzing the collapse of World Trade Center 7. We've made a number of steps, and Terry is going to walk you through those steps, but the I think the overall point of view is that we have taken a restock of the approach we need to use for this analysis, and we believe it's a much more robust approach that we're going to be using. And as a result of this new approach, we've also recompeted the contracts that we had used before, and we have a good group of contractors working with us. I would consider them world-class experts working with us, and working with Terry and the rest of the NIST team to conduct this work. And at this point, I'll just turn it over to Terry to describe for you the progress she's made. And Paul, unless you have any other questions, Terry can start her briefing.
Let me poll the committee. John Bossom?
I'm having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry.
Paul?
John, do you have any additional questions for Sean?
No.
Okay. Bob Hansen?
No comments at this time.
And Foreman Williams?
Nothing now.
John, I guess it's Terry's turn.
All right. Good morning. I'm going to summarize this morning the technical approach that's been developed by the investigation team and give you a status summary of where the investigation is presently at. I'm going to tell you as I change slides, since we're not all in the same room, going to slide two, a summary of what we'll cover today, the status of the investigation, the approach that's been developed for all the technical issues, that's a more comprehensive approach than we had previously, and progress that's been made to date. We will not be presenting any findings or conclusions today as the analyses are still ongoing. Going to slide three, a status summary, very briefly, is initially, let's step back and recall that when NIST initiated the investigation, we decided not to hire new staff, and as we were working through the investigation, when we issued the June 2004 progress report, we decided to halt work on WTC-7 until that work was done. So we resumed our work on WTC-7 last December 2005. Since then, we've made considerable progress. We reviewed nearly 80 boxes of new documents related to WTC-7. We've developed technical approaches that I'll be covering today. And as Sean said, we've selected contractors to support our work. We presently anticipate that a draft will be released by spring 2007. Moving to...
Somebody joined us. Do we want to take a moment to introduce themselves?
Yes. Good morning. This is Attorney Jerry Liepart.
Mr. Liepart, this is Steve Kaufman. We'd ask the public commenters to join at 10:30 during the break.
Oh.
There is an audio webcast that is available.
Okay.
Listen in.
All right. I'll call back at 10:30.
Yeah, we'll, the chairman will make an announcement at 10:30 for commenters to call in.
Very well.
All
thank
right.
you.
Thank you very much.
Starting on slide four now, just to refresh our memories of the working collapse hypothesis that was presented in June 2004, there were basically three events identified. An initial failure that occurred somewhere in the lower portion of the tower, which in these slides you'll see referred to as the initiating event, where the failure occurred due to fire or debris-induced structural damage of a critical column, which supported a large sand floor bay with an area of about 2,000 square feet. This was followed by the vertical progression of sequential failures, which resulted in the east penthouse movement downward, which was observed in the videos, as the interior structure supporting it was brought down. This led then to the third event, which was a horizontal progression triggered by debris falling from the vertical progression underneath the east penthouse. And thought is that in the regions of floors 5 to 7, which were much more heavily reinforced than the other floors, caused a lateral pull and a disproportionate collapse of the entire structure as the core columns were made unstable. Now, we want to say that this hypothesis may be supported or modified by the ongoing work, or a new hypothesis may be developed through the course of the continuing investigation. Going to slide 5, the overall investigation approach is based on 5 steps. Obtaining information about the building, the damage to the building, and the fires and collapse sequence that occurred. The second step is identifying event scenarios, initiating event scenarios, including the location of these initiating events and the type of failures that would have been occurring that led to the collapse as observed. And the types of initiating event scenarios that we are considering, fire events and blast events. The third step is to develop and validate or verify fire, thermal, and structural models similar to before, as well as conducting a finite element analysis. We have 4 steps here, identifying the initiation sites and the mechanisms leading to them, the growth and spread of fire, how heat is transferred to structural elements, and identifying the sequential events leading to collapse. And these 4 steps will then lead to determining the probable collapse sequence. Going to slide 6, this is a recap of the investigation plans we had a year ago in December 2005. The first 3 bullets summarize the data collection that was planned for the building and for the debris impact damage, and also the fuel that was either recovered or leaked into the ground by the fuel tanks in the building. The next series of bullets are related to analyses. We're going to conduct a preliminary analysis of global stability using the SAP model that had been developed, develop initiating event hypotheses to guide our analyses, conduct parametric studies to identify significant parameters for fires in WTC7, as well as thermal and structural response analyses. The 2 steps that are a little bit different here from before are the separation of the structural response to fire and then the analysis of sequential events following that initial event. We're using ANSYS to do the thermal analysis in terms of the structural response to damage and fire, and we'll be using LS-DYNA, which our contractor is going to be conducting a global analysis of WTC7 to look at how the global structure responds to initiating events. We also planned at that time to complete reports we had started on the Con Ed facility and seismic data that had been recorded with regard to WTC7. Moving on to slide 7. Since that time, we've identified the following topics that also need to be investigated. The top 3 bullets are related to topics that have been postulated by others, namely hypothetical blast scenarios, as well as the evaluation of thermite as a possible heat source substance towards softening of structural steel. And we have awarded a contract for evaluation of hypothetical blast scenarios. The additional bullets here, we've also awarded a contract to assist with the structural response of the structure to damage and fire events, where the contractor will be assisting the work ongoing at NIST. We evaluated the approaches for fire and thermal analyses to develop an approach that reflected the limited available photographic and building condition information. We have less information for WTC-7 than we had for the towers. We inspected the Bankers Trust building for fireproofing damage, looking for any parallels that could be drawn since that building was also impacted by exterior panels as WTC-2 collapsed. Since WTC-1 had impact damage from exterior panels by WTC-1 as it collapsed. We also decided to use the SAP analysis that we planned for global stability analyses to examine initiating event and, criteria, locations, and general understanding of how the building might respond. And the last item here, we will be evaluating the Manhattan dispatch case for the afternoon on 9/11 to get any additional data that might be available. Going on to slide 8, we've identified two sets of key technical issues. This slide here will talk about initial conditions. The next slide will talk about analyses. And there's four key technical issues for initial conditions. They relate to fireproofing damage, impact damage, the initiating event hypotheses, and fires. For the fireproofing damage, we're using three steps to estimate what the degree of fireproofing damage might be. We've obtained data about the initial fireproofing conditions available from contractors and inspection records. We are using the analytical approach developed for the WTC towers, but we're adding to that estimated distributions of acceleration from debris impact and distribution of the adhesive and cohesive strengths for the fireproofing. This gives us a range of conditions that might have existed in the building. And we also inspected the Bankers Trust building, as I had just described. We're going to use these three different sets of data and information to develop fireproofing conditions, which I'll be talking about a little bit more later. The lack of information about impact damage is due to the fact that we don't have any clear photos of the south face after the impact occurred, so we do have some images. We're looking at witness testimony as well as photographic information that's available to give the best definition we can get of impact damage. For the initiating event hypotheses, we've considered known fire locations and the building construction and layout to develop a series of possible initiating event hypotheses to consider in our analysis. For the fire size and location, as before, we've used photos and videos to map where the fires occurred on all four faces. The important point to note here is that we have less than 1% the number of photos and videos for WTC-7 that we had for WTC-1 and 2. And this has been a point that we've had to consider when we're conducting the fire analyses. We've also obtained as much information as we can from the building occupants about the particular furnishing content and floor layouts of each of the floors where fires occurred. Going on to slide 9, the key technical issues for analysis are based on four items: the steel frame connection, the fire analysis approach, the thermal analysis approach, and data transfer between the ANSYS and LS-DYNA structural analyses. We have a lack of information on the connections used in the steel frame for WTC-7, so we've identified three avenues of approach to address this issue. We've developed connection designs based on data available in the design drawings and standard practice when the building was designed in the mid-1980s. We're interviewing the building designers, and we've also obtained and are reviewing photographs that were taken during building renovation, which has given us some knowledge about the connection. We revised the fire analysis approach primarily to address the fact that we have such limited photographic and video information. So in addition to compiling potential ignition and firewall locations based on the building layout, we've also had to interpolate discontinuous data on fire spread where there's a gap in information. Similarly, since we have less information for the fire analysis, we examined the thermal analysis approach and simplified it so that we now have temperature variations.
Excuse me, Terry.
Yes.
Kez may have joined us. Hello?
Terry, I think somebody may have dropped off.
Let me poll the committee. John?
I'm here.
Bob?
I'm here.
Foreman?
I'm here.
Did then somebody join this conference call? Please speak up.
One of your staff, Sham?
Yeah, I think Matt said that some of the people can't see all of the bullets, sub-bullets in the slides.
Actually, Sham, it's on the link to the webcast. That's covered. I understand.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, Terry.
Okay, no problem. The thermal analysis has a simplified approach now that allows for temperature variation over the building floor area, but has a reduced amount of modeling detail by an order of magnitude. And we conducted some component and area analyses to support this approach prior to adopting it. The last issue, involves the data transfer that will be required between the ANSYS analysis and the LS-DYNA analysis. And we have an initial approach identified, but it will have to be refined as we start transferring data between the two models.
Just want to add here the main difference, the initiating event analysis is more detailed, it's local, and the main goal there is to find out what the initiating failure was, and then the LS-DYNA will look at the progression of failures, so multiple elements failing and the building coming down as a whole.
Yes, that's right, thank you. Going on to slide 10, this is a graphic just to illustrate some of the differences between the approach, between the analyses for WTC7 from what was previously identified for the towers. You'll see in the box up top that we do have debris impact damage estimates, and those, as before, will affect the fire, thermal, and structural analyses. The other thing I'd like to point to is the structural response to fire scenario being conducted by ANSYS and the global structural response to local failures, which is being accomplished with LS-DYNA. We did not have those separated previously, but we felt that we would make use of the advantages of each piece of software. ANSYS would be used for thermal response, and LS-DYNA would allow for dynamic response to an initiating event, so that we'll actually be able to model debris falling and a dynamic sequence of events taking place. So we felt that this approach would better address our needs for WTC7. And the last point I want to identify here is there's two sources of hypothetical initiating events, the fire, which we've discussed, and then the blast events, which I want to just briefly cover in the next slide. So let's go to slide 11. As part of this work, NIST is analyzing scenarios for events that initiated the collapse of WTC-7. So we are going to consider whether hypothetical collapse events that have been postulated by others could have played a role in the initiating the collapse. We have found no evidence of a blast or a controlled demolition event, but NIST will estimate the magnitude of the hypothetical blast scenarios that could have led to the structural failure of one or more critical elements. And we have three phases for this evaluation process. First phase is to identify the hypothetical blast scenario based on analysis or experience for failing specified columns by direct attachment method. And we were also considering preliminary section cutting, and we'll then look at the overpressures for each scenario against the ability of windows to withstand those overpressures. The phase two will evaluate the overpressures from an analytical point of view using Shamrock software that's been in use for a number of years. This is to look at cases where it's not clear that the windows might have been broken if there's a situation where it's not a clear-cut case that that might have occurred. And phase three, then, we'll take a look at how far the sound level, the sound would have traveled and at what level the sound would be at a distance away from WTC-7. And we feel this suite of analyses will allow us to address the issue of hypothetical blast scenarios. Moving on to slide 12. The analysis of, initiating events due to debris impact and fire events is also being conducted using the ANSYS model we've discussed. It's a model of the lower 16 floors as significant fires were observed between floors 7 to 13. This is a very detailed model, includes steel framing, concrete slabs with smeared properties, properties for elastic plastic and creep behavior of the at elevated temperatures, break elements for connection capacity, and of course the service gravity loads. And using this model, we will analyze up to 12 damage and fire scenarios based on two structural damage states, an upper and a lower bound based upon available evidence, assumed fireproofing conditions, and temperature histories that may be up to 7 hours long. If we go to slide 13, I've outlined the 12 cases that are being considered. Here you have the two damage states, one and two, and we also have the different conditions, whether fires occur on floors 7 to 13 only, or if they include floors 5 and 6. And then we have three fireproofing conditions, where you have either intact fireproofing, extensive loss of fireproofing, which is considered either a bare or 90% damage condition, and then a nominal 50% damage condition. And these are based upon variations in the adhesive bond strength that might have existed and the range of accelerations that might have been imparted to the building. And I do want to point out that the fireproofing condition was not directly observed, and its condition will be based on the analyses that I've described and the information we have about fireproofing bond strength. Going on to slide 14, this is the last part of our technical approach. The LS-DYNA analysis of global response to initiating events. This analysis will determine if a global collapse would result from a series of initiating events, whether due to fire or blast, which will be input as initial conditions. And this approach is being developed in two steps. First, a floor model was developed where we're looking at how the floor redistributes loads and the failure mechanisms that take place as the floor tries to redistribute loads. And the floor models are being used to inform the global analysis. And we have three steps in the global analyses. We first determine global structural stability for the two damaged states. We then follow that by a sensitivity study where we're going to look at up to 20 initiating events throughout the structure. And we'll either determine if it leads to a structurally stable condition or if it leads to a sequence of member failures that look somewhat close to what was observed for the collapse in the videos. And finally, then, we'll have a set of final analyses up to about five different scenarios where these have been identified as the ones most likely to result in a collapse scenario that matches what was observed. Okay, so if I move now to the last two slides, let's go to slide 15. This is a summary of the progress we've made since last year. We started by completing a table of initiating events to guide our analyses last December. In January, we reviewed 80 boxes of data and drawings that was held by SOM. In April, we awarded a contract.
Just a little bit. These 80 boxes of data were data related to the occupancy by city group of Salomon Smith Barney and the top half of the building.
That's correct.
Okay.
We awarded a contract to ARA for the LS-DYNA global analyses. Then we started conducting preliminary analyses of floor sections using ANSYS and looking at temperature-dependent behavior. We had preliminary simulations of fire progress and thermal heating of elements. This is part of developing the approach I described. We also looked at thermite as a possible, heat source substance. We completed information gathering on the building layout and content by July. Now, in August, we were able to go in and inspect the Bankers Trust building, looking for parallels with the fireproofing damage. We had started discussing that in March, but we're not able to go in until August, just due to a number of coordinating issues that came up with the group that was controlling Bankers Trust. And if I go on to slide 16, in August we had four other events. We completed preliminary analyses of WCC7 initiating events using the SAP model, which included developing connection details and failure criteria to inform that model. We awarded a second contract to ARA, where we Demolition International to assist with the development of blast hypotheses, and Simpson, Gumperts, and Hager to work with us on the ANSYS analysis of the structural response to fire and damage. And we also completed our analysis of visual evidence for the fire progression through the building and building damage that could be identified. We also completed the analysis of the seismic data that had been recorded at Lamont Dougherty. Then in October, the fire dynamic simulation fire models were completed for the floors. And based on some new information we obtained, we also updated the South Face Dam, which we got some new photos in. We also looked at the video information we had and were able to do an analysis of building vibration just as the building was starting to collapse. In the last few weeks, we developed the ANSYS model for thermal analyses and started those analyses. The LS-DYNA floor and global models were developed and have started the floor analyses. And we have developed hypothetical blast scenarios, which are being reviewed for analysis of overpressures.
Thank you, Jerry. Very quickly, I'll turn it over, but I just want to say that the end product of all this work, when it's finished, will be three reports. One will be simply a companion to the original 250-page summary report for the towers. So it'll be a written in story format, so a large audience can read it and understand it. The second report will be a detailed technical report that'll be written by NISTAF, much along the lines of the various technical reports we've written before, with all of the details in terms of the assumptions. This will cover the fire dynamics, the thermal analysis, and all of the structural calculations. And the third report, by the way, appendices to this report will include results from our seismic analysis, the work we did on the reviewing the Con Ed substation, the distribution system, the preliminary structural response analysis, and the hypothetical blast scenarios that Terry mentioned. And the third report will be the contractor report, which will be written by ARA based on the work they have done for us along with their subcontractors. At this point, Paul, it's back to you and for the committee to ask questions.
Okay, following the guidelines of going from the top down in alphabetical order, I'll first ask John Bossom if he has any comments, recommendations, or questions.
Yeah, it's a question of the relationship of what Terry just presented versus the other document that you send us, the collapse of Building 7 by Schumann. What is that, and is that going to be discussed before I ask my question?
That document was only sent to you because Mr. Sherman has asked to make a public comment during this meeting, and it's supporting documents that he has shared with the committee. It is not a document that has been reviewed or analyzed by NIST. So. It's really information that Mr. Sherman would like to share with the committee and with NIST, and he'll speak to it during the public comment session.
Thank you. That answers that part. So, Terry, I have a question. We know what the result was. We have a progressive collapse. We also have very sparse data. We don't have as many pictures. As a matter of fact, we have minuscule number of pictures compared to the towers. We have very sparse data on the fires. Considering the sparse amount of facts that we have, with all the sophisticated analyses we're going to go through, which I think are fine and everything else, what is the possibility of really having a scenario that by changing few things in it would change the picture and have another scenario? For example, I can take one column out of one place or three out of another place and have the same result. What's going to be the final result, and how much is it going to be? We're going to be able to defend it.
John, that's an excellent question, and it's a question we're grappling with. I think the state of our analysis at this point is in the same state we were in with regard to the towers, probably in early 2004. At which point we were not in a position to even speculate as to whether or not we will have a probable collapse sequence. We are going to bring the best science that we can and try to consider what-if scenarios. Obviously, there might be the leading hypothesis, but We will also try to ask the devil's advocate as to whether, in fact, this is a unique solution or is it just one of many that could have given us the answer. But I think at this point it's fair to say we're not in a position to give an assessment of that, where we might end at the where we might end up in a few months from now.
That's fine, Sean, but maybe the first step is make a list of what do we really know as facts, so that everybody is on the same page, and then what are the assumptions that are being made above and beyond those facts. That would help at least show where the assumptions were made, and people can think about them and see the validity of them in their own mind.
That's an excellent suggestion. We have been a beginning toward that. In fact, we've tried to analyze the interviews, the information we have to generate a timeline of events, and we're probably going to do the same thing with the photographs and with any other hard evidence that we have. So, but it's an excellent suggestion for us to move forward.
That's all I have, and Terry, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Next will be Bob Hanson. Bob?
Yes, I have two questions or two comments, I guess. Following up on John's, I guess when you're making these assumptions, you will, like you did in the towers, put some range of likelihood on the assumption so that you can do a variance in terms of the analysis? That's a question.
Bob, I'll try and answer that. In the case of the towers, we use a statistical process to understand uncertainty in variables. And I think when we get to a point where we think we are close enough, we will try and do that. I think we are at a point in time where that it's how to apply it is not clear yet. So I think it's a point we'll consider when we'll certainly consider to try and quantify uncertainty if you are able to do it in a rigorous fashion.
Okay, that's fine. The other comment goes to the hypothetical blast analyses. I assume that a lot of these blast analyses are conspiracy people, or rather than just blast-sensitive content people. And my basic question is, in your blast analysis, what time of day did these blasts occur?
I think that's part of what we're evaluating, Bob, is what can take place within the realm of designing a method to remove these columns, and where part of that is considering the time available and when it would have to occur. So that's part of what's being considered.
Because there's no way that they would know that the towers are going to collapse. So that means that they would have to go into the building after the collapse of the towers to install their blast material.
Well, Bob, that's, again, an outstanding comment. We are doing the blast analysis primarily for completeness. As we said, we haven't seen any evidence of controlled demolition or a blast event. And as you know, we put out a fact sheet just a few months ago with regard to the towers, where we actually say exactly what you just said, which is, any blast material would need to have been pre-positioned ahead of time and triggered to synchronize with the collapse of the building, and there are some, the probability of doing that, at least from where I sit at the present time, seems incredibly remote. But we just want to at least try and see if the hypothetical event, even if such improbable events, were actually synchronized to take place, could they be discriminated from the other more normal events that we think are the primary reasons why the buildings collapse?
Yeah, because it becomes a real logistical issue.
Yes.
That's all I have, John.
Thank you, Bob. Foreman Williams?
A point or two more about the fire-related stuff. I thought I heard Terry say when talking about slide 13 that the cases were that there was only damage at floor 7 and above initially, but as I read this slide, both of the damage states have damage both above floor 7 and also in 5 and 6. Do I read the slide correctly? Did I misinterpret what you said, Terry?
Let me see if I can explain it again. This is the table that you're referring to. What we're looking at is possible different scenarios. So let's say we have damage state 1. One scenario would be that the initiating event was caused by fires only on floors 7 to 13. Another possible scenario would be that fires on floor 5 and 6, as well as 7 through 13, caused the initiating event.
Well, okay, so the situation is that there are two situations that are analyzed for damage state 1 and two that are analyzed for damage state 2. Is that it?
There's actually six, because then you impose on top of that the fireproofing conditions. And this is addressing the fact that they were not directly observed, so we're going to look at a range of fireproofing conditions to get an understanding of the role they play.
There's six. I see four. I don't see
You see four?
Six.
Do you see the numbers 1, 2, 3 under?
Yes, I do.
7 to 13. That would be three scenarios. And then 4, 5, 6 under the second column. 5, 6, and 7 to 13.
Well, then I would get 12 scenarios.
Yes, when you add damage state 2, and there's a total of 12 scenarios.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'm following it now. Thanks.
Okay, sure.
My other question maybe goes to Dick Gann. These FDF calculations are pretty difficult for this building, especially with relatively little outside information. And I'm curious about whether it's necessary to reinitialize on the basis of observed fires from outside in different floors. I mean, was it like one continuous run where you would predict fire transfer from one floor to another, or did you have to stop and start again on the basis of some observations that are made at later times?
First of all, doing the FDS runs themselves is actually fairly straightforward. Choosing which runs to do and how many to do is not straightforward. FDS allows the, once you've started the fire, it just keeps the thing going.
I agree, and that's what I'm saying.
If we reached a point where the fire was behaving differently than the visual evidence, the photographs, then obviously we took a look at restarting or stopping the fire in that location to be consistent. Obviously the evidence is what counts. The simulation has to follow it. We also are doing sensitivity analyses to find out within the reasonable range of the variables, could there be things accounting for the visibility or non-visibility of the fire? For instance, on some of the floors, there are large numbers of interior partitions between the core of the building and the exterior face which the photographs can see. We need to know how long a fire could be hidden on the inside of a series of those partitions, hidden before you would see it break through and show up on the outside. And we've worked some of that. As we did with the towers, we varied the fuel load to make sure that, in fact, the progress rate of the fires is consistent. But yes, we are pinning all the simulations to those pieces of evidence we have, such as when were the windows broken, where were they broken, and so on.
I guess my bottom line question is, say in the best case run, how many times did you have to stop and restart the FDS analysis?
My recollection is that no more than once per run. I think that's where we are right now.
Okay, thanks.
Clement, that your last question?
Yeah, that's all I have. Thanks.
Okay, Clement. I have a couple of questions, Terry, just for sake of clarity, I think. In one of your slides, you made mention, you used the phrase large fan floor bay. I'm assuming that this refers only to that portion of the building that was over the substation, Con Ed substation. Have you been able to determine how the rest of the building in it was might have been tied in to this portion of the building over the substation, and what the connecting strength, if you will, for lack of a better term, might have been with some of those ties?
Well, let me answer. I think I heard two questions. The large span floor bay was referring to areas where we have 50-foot spans between the edge of the core and the exterior of the building, primarily along the north face and the east face. The core is not centered in the building, so that the south and west faces have shorter spans. You're asking how the building on a substation?
Yeah, in 2004, you were still investigating how the critical columns that supported this large span area were tied back to the rest of the building, and you were looking to get more structural drawings. And I'm just wondering if my notes from the 2004 this meeting are accurate. You were looking back to see what the ties were and the strength of those ties and how they might have initiated or pulled.
Yes. Let me try, and then maybe Terry can expand on that. The whole description of what Terry talked about in terms of working the initiating hypothesis or initiating event hypothesis is this analysis that we were trying to work on a couple of years ago. And yes, in the structural model at that time, we wanted to get better information on how the connections were designed in this building. It turns out that we don't have access to the detailed drawings. We have obviously access to most of the other information in terms of the members. So in order to develop the information on the details of the connections, we have talked to the company that originally was a structural engineering firm, and we've talked to other structural engineers of the era who know the practice in New York City and were in a position to tell us the kind of detailing that would have been used in a building in the mid-1980s. So we did do that, and with regard to the initiating event, the tieback of the column to the rest of the structure, we do have a pretty decent model of that now. And it's the exercise of that model and figuring out the what-ifs that are really being worked on at this present time.
And so that information can be used in the future analysis that's either going on or will be going on?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Second question I have, you indicated in June you had reviewed the seismic information. You mentioned specifically what the impact might have been on the fireproofing in the building itself. Have you done any analysis of what the damage might have been to piping, specifically the fittings and the pipings that were used in providing fuel, if you will, to these emergency generators that apparently are located in spots around through the building itself? And in addition, the piping that came in from the tanks that were located outside?
The seismic signals by themselves were not of any, the seismic strength of the event. Well, first of all, the seismic signals relate primarily to the collapse of the building, and therefore it's probably, they would have been too late to have really initiated a failure of the pipes or the fuel lines to cause the fires that was one of our hypotheses.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sham. I thought the seismic data you were going to look at was data associated with the collapse of the tower, particularly too.
Yes. Oh, yes. We did look. Obviously, we've looked at all of the seismic signals. The main focus of that was to establish the timing of the various events, and if any, again, using it also to see if there were any events that we could not explain other than it being the collapse of the towers and the World Trade Center 7. The signal's strength due to the collapse of the towers were not of any magnitude that was seismically significant from an earthquake design standpoint or from the design or failure of a structural component or of, I would say, a piping system that might be used in a structure. So there wasn't anything that gave us pause in terms of that being a significant seismic event to have ruptured the pipeline.
Is a pipeline rupture one of the scenarios that you're going to be looking at?
Well, when Terry talked about the fire in floors 5 and 6, the second, for each damage state, there's one case where we have fire on floors 5 and 6 plus 7 through 13. The fifth floor fire, as far as we know, was not a normal building contents fire, and our our hypothesis is that it's a fire caused by the pressurized fuel line there. But we also are seeing tremendous amount of fires on floors 7 through 13, which are normal building fires. They may have been ignited in some fashion that we may never find out exactly how they were ignited, but they were mostly normal building fires. And of course, as we saw in the towers, and we've seen in the large-scale tests such as Cardington tests, in the case of large-scale fires, you do have floor sagging as a significant event, and you do see impact or distress of the connections, and you do see column crimping at the tops of columns. So I think those are all the possibilities that we're going to be exploring due to the fires that were only there between floors 7 and 13.
One last question on this subject. Is there able to ascertain to what standard, if any, any of the combustible liquid piping in the building was?
Paul, this is Bill Gross-Sandler.
Hi, Bill.
We have not delved deeply into that, but there was we did have a review done on the fuel systems in general, that and a report was released, you probably recall, along with the initial tower report. There was an appendix or contractor's report that did review the status of the fuel systems. They did look at standard practices. The indication was that the piping was installed according to standard practice, and there was nothing there to suggest that anything unusual. The unusual event or the unusual design was the pressurized line that was pointed out in the original VPAT report. There was no code requirement against that. It was just a different way to do things, and then there was the hypothesis was generated from that unusual design, let's call it just an unusual design, that if it were to break in a certain way at a certain time, there would the normal safety features in fuel systems may not have operated appropriately, and therefore you had a possibility of building up a substantial pool of liquid or spray that would have led to an intense fire. But we have not found anything to suggest that the piping itself did not follow the standard procedures of the day.
I have not seen that contractor report you referred to.
Well, maybe I'm describing it properly, but
first of all, it was documented in the Project 1 report, which would be NCSTAR 1-1, and there is a contractor report, which is one of the appendices under 1-1.
Oh,
okay. We'd be happy to send it out to the advisory committee after we finish this meeting.
Okay.
It's on the website, but we'll give you the link.
I'd like to see that.
And there might be a little bit more information that will come when our Con Ed study is finished in terms of the... Bill, can you briefly describe the scope of the Con Ed study?
Yes, the scope of the Con Ed study was more to understand the layout of that building, what kind of what equipment was located in the building, what observations were made by the people who were in there, were there any sensing, was there any information that was generated from that building that might give us an idea of what was going on. We were not looking at the structural details of the Con Ed building per se, and that was so that there won't be anything that will address that particular part of your question, but but we are dealing with the tie back and the transfer trusses and so on in other sections of our report, so that information will be included. And so in the Con Ed study, which will be an appendix to the main report, try to identify, again, the sequence of events that may have occurred that could have contributed. There was nothing that came out of that report gave us a lead, let me say that way, that, here's a new lead we might want to follow. So it's there for background and information and more or less to eliminate some other possibilities that may have occurred. Is that satisfactory, Paul?
Yeah, but I still would like to see that contract.
On the fuel system.
Fuel system.
Oh, yeah, we'll send that out.
The reason I bring it up is that we find in our experience that sometimes when you get into fuel systems of this type, they use a very conventional piping system, oftentimes using fittings, which result in weak points, if you will, on the piping.
Yes.
Whereas in reality, if it was a flammable liquid system and designed properly, it would all be welded, and you'd stay away from any kind of flexibility. At some point, if you had this unusual fire, you're going to have to give the scenario as to what triggered it, which leads me to a very quick question. The 80 boxes of material you looked at that came from, I believe you said, Smith Barney, was there anything different in that review that would indicate the occupancy was anything atypical to what the occupancy in the towers was like, for a typical workstation type arrangement that you see in financial centers almost everywhere? Was it anything atypical about it?
The two parts of the answer. The first one is no, there was nothing that we saw that was unusual. The second part is that the Smith Barney occupancy was on the upper floors. Because of the way the building came down, our focus for where the impact of the fires on the structure would be most likely to have contributed to that in the lower floors. We do have, as a result of communications with the occupants of the floors up through floor 13, a moderate amount of information about the types of furnishings, density, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, thank you. My only other comment concerns the blast analysis. I think I've commented before that I don't see the need to do this based on the information that you found to date, i.e. no evidence, and also based on the information you've been able to gather about potential scenarios regarding what may or may not have been stored in certain offices in the building. But I notice on December 6th, you completed the, if I can find it, developed the hypothetical blast scenarios for the analysis of overpressures. I'm wondering if you could feel comfortable at this point in time telling us what those scenarios might be.
Paul, I don't think we're far enough along that we're prepared to talk about that right now.
Okay. That's the end of my questions. Let me go around the table once more and ask John Bossom if he has anything additional.
No, I do not right now.
Bob Hansen?
Nothing at this time.
And Foreman Williams?
No.
Well, thank you, Terry and staff, for giving us a review of that, and I guess that completes the discussion on the progress report of collapse of WTC 7. Thanks very much, Terry.
You're quite welcome.
Excuse me while I pull up the agenda again.
Yeah, I guess the next item on the agenda is the discussion of the advisory committee report to Congress, Paul.
Yes. After thinking about it, for the benefit of the committee, after thinking about it, in fact, I had intended to do it earlier, in order to frame this discussion or at least give it a basis from which we can proceed, I decided I would draft a letter report addressed to, as always, the Secretary of Commerce, reporting on the 2006 activities of our committee. In the past, when we prepared reports, they've been fairly detailed, small books, in fact. But this year, because there's been no new investigations and very little activity of the committee, and maybe in an attempt to make our report more accessible, for lack of a better term, I decided that perhaps we should think about just a simple letter report highlighting the two or three most important things that we believe that the committee has been involved in, as well as reinforcing and/or deleting materials in our earlier reports. So this is very much that's actually the second draft that you're looking at, because the first draft I threw away. But this is very much a working draft. It is absolutely open for discussion in terms of format, content, or the like. But I would like to get a long way down the road this morning and get some consensus and agreement that what the format and what the content should consist of. I'm assuming you've all had a chance to read it. I noticed just as we started this meeting, I received an email from Steve Kaufman, which attached comments that Foreman Williams had made. And following the reverse alphabetical order of comments and the like, I would ask Foreman Williams if he would like to offer his suggestions, recommendations on anything he chooses about the report itself. Foreman, I'll start with you.
Hey, thanks, Paul. No, I really completely agree with your ideas for format and content. I thought they were really excellent, Paul, to tell you the truth. I understood, I think, very clearly the first two paragraphs, and then I started to read a few sentences that I felt I really didn't understand what you were saying. So what I've done is merely revised the text to a form that I felt that I could understand, but I don't really think that I've changed any of the content. My intent was not to change any of the content, so I think that I've pretty much gone along with the original version, but just rewritten it in a form that I feel that I personally understand better. That's all.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Bob Hansen, do you have any...
Yeah, I went through the letter, and I guess I have just two general issues, and other than editorial types of things, and I won't address those here. The attachment. You have a question mark whether or not we need to attach advisory committee recommendations from the past, and I guess I would discourage that. I think the letter by itself stands alone.
Okay.
I think it's stronger that way. However, I would suggest that your third paragraph belongs for at the end of the letter, because that, in a sense, is our recommendation this year.
Yes, it is, isn't it? Okay.
Now, I mean, the thanks to Jim Hill, I don't know where that fits in, but I think the last thing you want to leave into the minds of the people reading this is that they've got some work to do. They haven't done their work. That's just my input.
John Bassam?
Yeah, just following on Bob's comment, you may just want to make the last paragraph you have in there about thanking Jim, eliminating conclusion, and just start the committee, and then put that paragraph that Bob suggested at the end, saying something to start it with as a concern or something by the committee. This is our recommendation, or whatever the right words are. Otherwise, did a good job, buddy, as usual.
Foreman here, may I?
Yep.
Paul?
Foreman Williams?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree with the suggestion of putting that third paragraph at the end. I think it fits in okay. I mean, your last paragraph said in something like, in conclusion, the committee expresses its appreciation. I think that is worth, I didn't see any real need for your final sentence of that paragraph, which is what I took out in I don't think it's that we have to pat them on the back. They're doing fine work, but I don't think we have to, you know, commend them for their dedication and so on. It's sufficient to just do that, but if you simply want to take away the in conclusion part, then that's a one sentence paragraph, which certainly is a good one to have there, and then we could put that third paragraph at the end. That would be a possible way to go.
Okay. I'll just make one editorial suggestion. Paragraph that begins, the committee met once during 2006, I intend to up to the top of the letter, just to, because it is an activity type of thing, and make editorial changes in the very first paragraph. It's strictly just to let, you know, whoever reads it know that we did meet once, that's being the meeting that we're having today. And then we would continue on with the paragraphs. And I'll use Foreman's editorial revisions as the base document from this point on.
Okay. Sounds
and,
good.
Just for the record, I reserve a question mark after the outstanding recommendations is that I happen to agree with Bob. I don't think we need anything more than the letter. And if somebody wants to go back and find out what they were, they can read our other reports.
I agree. I think we all agree with that.
Yes. So that will be gone. I think we're all on that same page. I will get Steve a draft of this. Probably won't be till tomorrow, Steve. Fortunately, I have holiday decorating to. and we will circulate it to the entire committee for final comments before transmitting it to the secretary.
That's fine, Paul. The question was just raised here, whether the committee needs to vote on this. It sounds like everybody's in agreement, but we might just want to call that to a vote just to make sure that we've captured that for the record.
Good suggestion. I will accept a motion that the committee accept the report with the changes that were suggested and which I will execute the next 24 hours.
So move.
So move.
Second.
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 All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. And aye. It is, by my watch, 10:24.
Paul, I got old business?
Yes, old business, yes.
For some reason, I do not have a similar report from 2005.
Yes, that's true.
Neither do I.
One was not prepared.
Okay. Does the lack of a report need to be noted?
I hadn't thought of it, but I'm open to discussion on that.
No, just ignore it.
Noted where, Bob?
Well, that's the whole problem. So I just want to make sure I wasn't out of the loop in something.
Oh, you weren't.
Okay, so no, just ignore it.
Okay. Any other old business? Any new business? Hearing that, I would suggest that we take a 10-minute recess that will allow NIST to make connections with the individuals who want to address the committee. You can do that, if I'm correct, Steve, by hitting *6. It'll put you offline.
That's correct, or if you have a mute button on your phone, that will also do it. At this time, Paul, we'll take a 5-minute break. We have two folks who have registered to speak during the public comment period, and I'd like to ask those two folks to call in. They have the call-in information, so if they would call in at this time and be prepared to speak when we resume.
We both at
10:35.
That's what the agenda says.
Yes.
Okay, so we can just leave this open line connection, right?
You can leave the connection open. That's correct.
Okay.
Just make sure if it's on mute, because anything you say will be carried in the audio webcast to the whole world.
I never say anything that's embarrassing.
Okay, we'll see you in just about exactly 10 minutes.
Right.
Are we connected?
Yes, you are connected.
Okay, thank you.
We'll start in just about 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Are both of our speakers on the call? Mr. Leapart, are you with us?
I am.
Okay. Mr. Sherman?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thank you very much. Is the advisory committee ready to resume?
I'm here.
One. Paul, are you with us?
I am there.
Okay. John Barsom, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and Foreman Williams, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Paul, I'll turn it over to you then.
Thank you. Do we have the individuals who wish to address the committee online?
Yes, sir.
Yes, we do.
And Mr. Leapart.
I'm here.
Gentlemen, you've been allotted 5 minutes to address the committee. At approximately the four-minute mark, I will inform you that you have about 1 minute to go. And you should at that point in time begin to conclude your remarks or summarize your remarks. We appreciate you taking the time to be with us and to discuss your recommendations. I would point out that the committee is currently preparing its report to Congress, and that is the primary purpose of this particular meeting. and would ask that you include in your remarks your recommendations as to what you would like the committee to report to Congress itself. We'll start with Mr. Sherman. He had previously sent us a document which is under advisement by the committee. Mr. Sherman, you're on the floor, and the clock is running. It's all yours.
Okay, thank you. WTC's Building 7 was the 47-story office building completed in 1987 by Silverstein's Properties on land owned by the Port Authority. It was built according to Port Authority codes to allow for tenant alterations in tower buildings. Building 7 was not hit by any planes, but had some damage from parts of Tower 1 impacting the south wall. Because of the damage to the building and the failure of the water supply, after talking to the owner, the fire department decided to evacuate the building and not to attempt to control the fires, but let them burn out. Since it was a fire-resistant building, there would have been every expectation that the fires would burn out without any local collapse. However, given that the towers had collapsed and that there had been serious interior collapse of Building 5, I was concerned, and the collapse area around the building was cleared. The building suffered global collapse from fire after several hours of uncontrolled burning. There were no known injuries or fatalities in the collapse. Building 7 was built over an existing Con Edison power station. Above the 7th floor, the construction was very similar to that of the towers, with long span outer floors, large open areas, unknown fireproofing on the steel, little lateral bracing in the core, and most likely weak column splicing. Since the perimeter wall column was sheer walls that resisted wind loads, the long span floor is 53 feet, acted as a diaphragm transferring loads between the exterior walls and between walls and the core. The center core structure, as in the tower, was supported on gravity loads. One important difference from the towers was that instead of steel bar joists, the primary floor structure had 2 feet deep wide flange steel I-beams 9 feet on center composite with a concrete slab. The long span steel I-beams had 3/4 inch diameter by 5 inch long shear studs about 2 feet on center that projected into the concrete. These studs provided bonding and composite action under load at the 5.5-inch concrete floor. Shear studs were not provided in the core. Similar sorts of floor failure mechanism that is not responsible for the tower's collapse might have been responsible for Building 7's interior column failure, triggered the progressive collapse. This study showed that failure of one or more of these key interior columns on the east side of the building would travel vertically to the roof, collapsing all the floors, and producing the initial kink in the east penthouse roof, the first indication of collapse as videotaped. The west penthouse roof sank into the building, as seen in the videotape, 5 seconds after the east penthouse roof sank, indicating a horizontal collapse progression in the rectangular core, imploding the building. The fire appears to be as shown in the photos, appears to be a very severe but ordinary office fire and was well above the area supplied with oil lines. This is on floor 12. There was a strong possibility that this building collapsed from this office fire alone. Light was first seen on the south side spreading east and then photographed coming out of 8 windows on the east side of the 12th floor. This fire must have dropped down to the 11th floor since a later photo shows fire at 4 windows on the 11th floor. There was also fire showing at multiple 12th floor windows on the north side. This is a serious high-rise building fire that would have necessitated multiple alarms to control. The photos were taken about 2 p.m. Building collapsed about 3 hours later after the 12th floor fire had burned out.
Mr. Sherman, yes. 4 minutes have gone by. You should use your remaining minute to summarize your remarks.
Okay. The possibility exists that some weaknesses exist in high-rise buildings constructed with long-span floors and cores without lateral bracing and with weak column splices. This can do a computer analysis of the forces involved in connection strength to confirm or disprove this analysis and clarify the theory. But the increasing spans and size of floor areas in high-rise office buildings allowed by the use of steel, there is a critical need for new methods to test long-span floors to determine if they are or can be adequately protected from fire. New methods should be developed for testing and determining the forces that affect these floors and their connections under collapsed conditions. Long-span I-beams may be affected by differential heating and expansion of different parts of the web or flanges, causing early bowing, buckling, or twisting, affecting structural integrity. Contraction of steel, of sagging steel beams or girders may put extra pulling forces on columns, pulling them out of alignment or buckling them.
Mr. Sherman?
Thank you.
5 minutes is concluded.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next person to address the committee is Mr. Jerry Liepat. Mr. Liepat, the floor is yours.
Thank you. My name is Jerry Liepart. I am an attorney at law having an office in Danbury, Connecticut. I make this statement on behalf of myself and in furtherance of consultation had with certain members of the organization known as Scholars for 9/11 Truth, Incorporated, a Wisconsin nonprofit corporation. First, a comment on the web page entitled, quote, NIBS Building Code Experts, Translating WTC Recommendations into Model Building Codes, unquote. The date references December 8, 9, 2006, appear to be erroneous. They actually pertain to meetings held in 2005, and the webpage should be corrected. Substantively, my comments are based on a concern that NIST's, quote, statement on progressive disproportionate collapse provisions, unquote, and NIST's currently existing, quote, recommendations following the federal building and fire investigation of the World Trade Center disaster, unquote, are based on misleading and inaccurate information.
Mr. Liepart?
On the one hand, it is my time going to be held while we discuss your concern?
No, sir. I just wanted to point out to you that your comments need to be limited to the scope set out by the agenda for this meeting, which regard the report to Congress that the advisory committee is preparing, and also the status of the World Trade Center 7 investigation.
They are related. Thank you very much for your insight. On the one hand, it may be appropriate to adopt new standards and to implement certain new recommendations pertaining to progressive collapse as defined in the United Kingdom. However, it is incongruent to base such changes in standards upon the content of NIST NC Star 1, the document otherwise known as, quote, the final report on the collapse of the World Trade Center towers, unquote. Apparently, I am not the only observer to have made this connection
Mr.
between...
Mr. This is the federal program official for this committee. The comments you're making are on NC Star 1. NC Star 1 is not the subject of today's meeting. Today's meeting on World Trade Center 7 and the specific discussion that took place with regard to the report of the committee to Congress. So the comments you're making are outside the scope of the comment period that was provided to you on the Federal Register notice. So if you have any comments specifically related to World Trade Center 7, the work we're doing, and specifically related to the Advisory Committee's report that was discussed, you can have a comment period. But if you have any other comments that you'd like to submit to NIST, you can send them to us by email.
Say your name again.
I am Shyam Sundar. I'm the lead investigator for the investigation as well as the designated federal officer for this advisory committee.
Thank you for that clarification, and I will respond accordingly.
Thank you.
The written version of the ongoing investigation of WTC-7 was modified beginning in or about October of this year to indicate that hypothetical blast events would be considered as a part of the ongoing investigation. It is good that the words, quote, hypothetical blast events, unquote, have belatedly entered into NIST's lexicon with respect to the still incomplete but nonetheless ongoing investigation of the apparent demolition of World Trade Center Building Number 7.
4 minutes have been taken. You should begin to summarize your remarks.
Actually, I had asked earlier if the 4 minutes would be held in abeyance during the portion of my comments that were interrupted.
Yeah, yeah,
I had understood that they would be.
I have stopped the clock, and while Mr. Sunder, Dr. Sunder was explaining to you what the, and before that, Mr. Kaufman, so I've stopped it twice, and I'd stopped right now, so you're in your final minute, so if you could summarize your comments and within the next minute. Thank you.
Okay. Let me conclude this comment by indicating that a written version of it will be submitted, and the written version will call attention to significant visual evidence that establishes probable cause to conclude that World Trade Center 1 and 2 were destroyed by actual blast events and not hypothetical blast events, to borrow a phrase that has belatedly entered into NIST's lexicon with respect to World Trade Center 7. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Leopold. That concludes the public comment period, and with that, it concludes the agenda as prepared. Are there any other comments from the committee members? John Bossom?
Thank you, and everybody, happy holidays.
Thank you.
Everybody, you folks, too. Thank you.
Bob Hantham?
No comments. Happy holidays to everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. And Foreman Williams?
I would just say that I think that Mr. Sherman's analysis, I found, well, he submitted some written material, which I found to be interesting, and I think it was a worthwhile study, and I'd like to compliment NIST for sharing their information with him, helpful to him, and that's all I wanted to say.
I have one question in that regard, if I might.
Yes, Mr. Hanson.
Is Mr. Sherman's information that was sent to the committee, is that a public document, or is that a committee hold document?
No, it's a public document. It'll be posted on our website.
Okay, so I can make copies for other people.
Bob, just a clarification. This is Steve Kaufman. It will be posted along with the minutes of this meeting.
Okay, so it's a matter of timing.
Yes.
As part of the minutes, Steve.
That's correct.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, there being no other, I would accept a motion for adjournment.
So move.
Second.
On Barson.
And all in favor, say aye.
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 To the NIST staff, thank you for arranging this conference call meeting and for bringing us up to speed on what your plans are in the investigation of WT7. And with that, and along with best wishes from the chair to everybody for a great holiday season and a very successful investigation, I call this meeting adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.